It is time for the single coolest sports show in the country, The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics.
You've got Matt Bonner, who my notes tell me is a sandwich blogger named Red Mamba. I mean, how can you not like a guy like that?
And the Red Rocket knocks down the triple.
Red Rocket, telling you, Red Mamba might not miss a shot.
Just like in politics, in the instructional video business, you need credibility.
You want credibility? I'll give you credibility. Hey, Tim, what's my nickname?
The Red Rocket.
No.
The Sandwich Hunter.
No. Fry Gun.
The Medium Fundamental.
And welcome to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan here in the great state of New Hampshire. No shortage of topics of conversation on the show today. March Madness, opening day for the Red Sox, Celtics not doing so great as of late, and of course, Rob Gronkowski retiring. Some question as to if this is legit and if Gronk is going to stay retired or if this is something that he may change his mind about, but you know, certainly got to take it at face value. Dude put out an Instagram message and statement about retiring. Seemed like he did catch the Patriots off guard as they didn't have a prepared statement. But I think that this is likely it for Gronk. We talked about it during the course of the season that he has had the injuries mount up. He's had back surgery. He's had elbow surgery. He's had issues with his knees. He's taken a beating during the course of his career. But one thing is for certain, Rob Gronkowski is not just a Hall of Famer, but he is a legend. He is one of those guys that you will forever hear about because of the way that he played the game and changed the game. So welcome in Matt Bonner to discuss. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you? And I'd also like to point out he's a cultural legend as well.
Yeah, he is. And now he's going to be even more of a cultural legend, I think, during his retirement. But if you want to call it that. Can you retire at 29? I wish I could have done that. You retired at, what, 36, was it? 35?
36.
Yeah, so Gronk, you know, I think, again, when we talked about when Manny retired, like, he was a one-of-the-kind type of player. And Gronk, you think about the heyday, and this is not hyperbole, he would be doubled or triple-teamed at times. And he would still make plays and be dragging guys down the field. And, you know, we've seen all the highlights over the last couple of days. And it's a huge loss for the Patriots. I think it's good for Gronk. Whenever a player retires because of health issues, you know, I'm glad he's making this choice and determination. But a huge loss because even with, you know, a downward trend in regards to his productivity, he still had all those huge catches in the playoffs, and he's a guy that you have to game plan for. You have to account for, even if he's not the player that he once was.
Yeah, and also he did all the little things.
Yes, the blocking.
Yeah. He understood how to execute within that offense, what his role was on each and every play. And he had an intuitive relationship with Brady on the field. But they just kind of got each other. That was a thing of beauty as well. And you mentioned how clutch he was. You know, he might go a game with two catches, but those two catches were like two most important catches of the whole game. That's just the kind of player he was. And I agree with you with the injury stuff. You know, he has taken a beating, and you got to remember when you're a professional athlete and you're retired, you still basically have your whole life ahead of you.
Right.
So looking out for the quality of that remaining part of your life is important, I think.
And Rob Gronkowski was a legendary player because of his ability, his size, his hands, his speed, but also his dedication to football and his dedication to his craft. You know, he may be goofy and fun-loving and love the party and all that, but when it came time for football, he was incredibly serious and demanded a lot of himself, both in the weight room and on the practice field, and that translated to, you know, the playing field. And he was just a rare and unique combination of, because a lot of times you'll see guys that are that size, but they don't have that that fire to utilize their size and to impose punishment as it's imposed on them. And he combined all these unique elements, which made him a one-of-a-kind type of player. To have those types of hands where he'd be have two guys draped on him, and he's still able to make that one-handed catch. He just was a complete package. And as we were talking about, it's going to be this is the most difficult loss the Patriots have had during the Belichick-Brady era because of what he means throughout the course of the offense, how he helped everyone else, because you had to be aware of him and how he helped in the running game as well. He was a huge part of the Patriots establishing the run this year, the way they were able to do, and Sony Michel's impact, and there's really no replacement for him on the roster.
Yeah, and going back to the beginning of that beautiful soliloquy, he does have that dog in him, like that competitor.
Right.
And that's an intangible thing that's hard to teach. You either have it or you don't. He definitely had it. And he didn't just apply it to games, you mentioned, but he applied it to everything, to preparation, to off-season training, to partying. But, he went hard at everything he did, which I think people can respect. That being said, that competitiveness, it will be interesting to see how he deals with that moving forward in retirement. How do you fill that void? Is he going to want to come back and make a comeback? Is he going to find something else? It'll be interesting to see what he pursues.
Is that the most difficult part of being a retired athlete, is that filling that competitive void, and also the adoration side of things as well, where there's, you still get some applause when you walk into the house, but it's not the same as that feeling you get when you hit a 3-point shot and there's, 18,000 people cheering for you, and there's the breath that comes before when the shot goes up, and then when folks get really amped up when the shot drops. So how difficult are those two things for a former athlete to fill?
Well, the adoration of fans, it's more of a question if you are over yourself. If you go through your career putting, I think Gronk falls in this category as a guy who puts the team first,
mm-hmm.
cares more about winning than just, how many fans you have or how many social media likes you get, all that kind of stuff. Then once you retire, you kind of feel secure in yourself. You have that self-confidence. I'm joking. And then the other part...
You're crying thinking about all the fans who used to cheer when you made those threes.
I'm seriously joking on something. Hold on, let me take a sip of water here. This is live radio, folks.
Yeah. Didn't work for Marco Rubio, but it worked for you.
Now I've forgotten what the first part of your question was.
I don't know if there was a first part. It was about the void, the competitive. Void? What is the most difficult part? So you're not consumed by the adoration of the cheering fans,
but you're
a very competitive individual. So how difficult is it to fill that?
In my opinion, it's almost impossible. Yeah. Like, especially if you're passionate about the game. There's some guys who at the end of their career aren't super passionate about their sport, and I think it's easier, but if when you go out, the fire's still burning, it does make it hard, because there's really nothing you can do to substitute that adrenaline, that competitiveness, the camaraderie in the locker room, all that. I mean, coaching's probably the closest thing you can get to it, but that's sometimes difficult, because it's just such a grind. It's not for everybody. So you gotta figure out what you can do that you're passionate about to commit yourself to try to do your best to fill that void, knowing you're never going to completely do it.
The difficult and different aspect of this, too, for Gronk, and your situation is pretty much the same as 99% of other athletes where, you don't leave the game leaves you. And Gronk has made a conscious decision of, teams may still want me, the Patriots may still want me, but I'm going to walk away. And so you have that aspect of control, but you also have that aspect of, there's still a door open here for me, and if I want to do this, I can still do it. And maybe some athletes think, and we see individuals try to make comebacks all the time, or we hear about athletes trying to make comebacks, so even when the game has left them, they're still trying to get back into the game. But it's different here for Gronkowski, because he has consciously made the decision to walk away. So you wonder how that competitive aspect is going to play with him in regards to that.
Yeah, I mean, the equalizer in that is why he's retiring, your health.
Right.
But dealing with the pain and the recovery and
right.
all that stress, that takes its toll. And, you know, if you think, hey, I want to try to make a comeback, and you start training at the level you need to train in order to do so, you get reminded pretty quick, oh, okay, this is why
right.
I stopped playing.
Right, right.
And it makes you feel a little better about your decision.
This is the Life of Matt Bonner presented by Concord Orthopedics. Get to the NCAA tournament here as well as Celtics and Spurs from Sunday night. We'll do the tournament right here, and you know, we pretty much hit it spot on in regards to our thoughts on this, on the tournament, where there's not a lot of difference between the teams in this tournament this year. We've seen teams that, you know, seeded pretty low make it to the Sweet 16. We've seen the top seeds really outside of North Carolina and Virginia. Now, Virginia did get tested in the first round, and North Carolina was down at the half to Iona. So even they got tested a little bit. Duke with an absolutely thrilling, in my view, game of the tournament, where it didn't look like they were going to win that game against University of Central Florida, and they did. Zion Williamson with an incredible play late to get the bucket and then get to the line, then misses the free throw, offensive rebound for Duke, and then UCF with two chances at the buzzer to win that game, and the ball rolls off the rim on each of the opportunities. So your takeaways from the tournament.
Well, for me personally, in my bracket, I played it safe, and it paid off pretty well. 14-16 in the Sweet 16, just basically going with the selection committee. And I didn't watch as much college basketball this year as I normally do, so I kind of figured, hey, these people are the experts at figuring out who should be seeded, what. I'm rolling with them. I picked a few first-round upsets here and there that luckily paid off, but to me, it was a weird tournament in that you had a lot of major athletic department universities in high seeds, high mm-hmm. seed at large bids, like 12s and 10s and 11s. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like it's weird to see like Florida and Oregon and I don't know who else, but like in double digit at large berths.
Ohio State.
Yeah, Ohio State. So like if you're a team that, you know, you work your butt off during the regular season and you get a great record, you're ranked all year, and then you get a high seed and you have to play like Ohio State or mm-hmm. Oregon in the first round. It's like, oh, like, what the heck? Come on.
Yeah.
So that's kind of weird to me, but I picked Duke to win it all just because, I don't know if we talked about it last week, I mean, you got three top 10 picks on mm-hmm. one college team. I just, in one of the greatest coaches of all time, I feel like they're going to find a way. I mean, obviously, the huge caveat is they can't shoot threes. And my co-host on Spurs Live, he's huge into analytics, and he informed me that no team who shot less than 30% from three on the season has ever won a national championship.
Which makes sense.
Duke was 29% this year, so testing that theory.
No, I think you make a good point.
I'm like, you could have told me that before the tournament started.
In that game against UCF, you kind of saw what great players can do. And that's a game that, you know, really Duke didn't deserve, quote-unquote, to win. But their great players were able to make plays down the stretch against a team that played better than them. And, you know, we talk a lot in the tournament about that one kind of game that you have to overcome, that hurdle that you have to overcome. And for Duke, that game may have been that.
Yeah, and I think Tennessee went through the same thing.
Yeah.
The thing with those teams that are kind of in the 1-2 slot, especially when they're going against a smaller conference team, and I would call UCF a smaller conference
mm-hmm.
team, they have such a athletic, physical advantage
mm-hmm.
that's what they kind of lean on when it comes to crunch time. It's kind of a shame because it ends up having a bigger effect than just execution and skill at that level, I think. The teams, you know, Kentucky's another team like that. They just have such superior athletes that when it comes down to it, they can go get a block shot, get finished with a dunk, get a couple offensive rebounds. That's what Duke did in order to keep themselves in the game and eventually winning. And that stuff, to me, it doesn't really have anything to do with basketball. It's just that they have superior athletes. I mean, and obviously that's a huge part of the reason why they're so successful. But you look at that UCF game, UCF should have won that game.
Yeah.
It's just, like you said, Duke made some plays down the stretch, and I would say the plays they made weren't great basketball plays. They were just bigger, stronger, more athletic.
What do you think of the 7'6" dude, forget his last name, on
Taco Fall.
Yeah. Do you think he works in the NBA? Is that, or is he that era of the Manute Bowles and, you know, Sean Bradley type players? I'm not putting Boban in that category because Boban's the greatest big that's ever lived. But do you think that era has kind of passed by, or do you think he has an NBA game?
I don't know if he's going to develop into a star, but I think he has a place in the NBA. And I know you don't want to put Boban in that category, but I think Taco Fall should shake Boban's hand. That would be the biggest handshake in the history of humankind. Because I think Boban's a guy who paved the way for a team to say, you know what, we could use a second, third string center who can come in, give us spot minutes, shake the game up. Is a fan favorite.
Mm-hmm.
People love huge people like that. And you know, I know from talking to Coach Donnie Jones, who's one of my assistants at Florida, who coached UCF before their current coach and who recruited Taco there, that he's a really great kid, nice person, low maintenance off the court, cares about his studies, you know, does all the right things, cares about the community. So I think given all those factors, he'd be a great fit on any NBA team. Again, a consistent starter, a star, that's kind of up to him. But I think he does have a place in the NBA.
Yeah, I think he gets a shot, and you know, we'll see if he is able to have a any sort of, as you referenced, a consistent presence in the league for a team, and is able to get in the rotation. But yeah, I was impressed with his quickness. His length is incredible. I mean, that's the thing about Boban too. Boban's 7'3", but his length makes him as big as anybody who's ever played the game in terms of his hand size and his wingspan. And so he doesn't obviously have the touch or the offensive game that Boban has. But, you know, we could see if that obviously will develop. So the first round, there were a lot of upsets. Second round, as you referenced, the teams that did well in the first, like Murray State, they got blown out. Some of the other teams as well, Liberty losing, UC Irvine lost the 12 in Oregon, but for the most part,
with the exception of the state of Kansas,
yep,
they messed my bracket up.
That's
Kansas,
not good.
Kansas
they
state. Yep.
That's not good for Kansas getting beat by Auburn down year for Kansas. They get bounced from the tournament, and Kansas State as well. It's the Life of Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I'm going to hear from Alex Cora, Red Sox manager, in the next segment of the show. But first, Celtics, dude. Celtics have lost four straight games, lost to the Spurs, and, you know, there's been a lot of rock bottoms this year for the Celtics, and obviously significant injury situation with the Celtics, but a lot of depth this team, and it seems like, you know, we're getting closer to the playoffs, eight games away, and the Celtics are still finding themselves. Spurs, I think, can make some noise out west. Love the way Marcus Aldridge is playing. Portal looked good. I think the Spurs are on the upwards trend. Celtics in a rough spot right now.
Yeah, I don't even know where to start. I guess I'll start with Spurs because that's the positive in this conversation. Yeah, they've won 9 of their last 11. The two games they lost were Miami at home somehow, and you know they should have won that game, and then they had Houston down 6 with, you know, a couple minutes left and got a tough call, offensive foul on DeMar DeRozan. Looked like it could have been an and one. James Harden did a patented, you know, I'm not going to use the word, but got the call. And then, you know, anyone who watched the NBA a few nights ago knows what happened. He just right. went nuts in the last few minutes of that game, ended with 61, and they pulled it out. I mean, those two games, they could be on an 11-game win streak right now. But they're playing. This is the Spurs we've been waiting to see all season. I think a lot of it has to do with being healthy for 100% healthy for a consistent stretch, and that's the ultimate two goals that you strive for come playoff time. Part one, be healthy. Part two, be playing your best basketball. And the Spurs are healthy and they're playing their best basketball with eight games to go.
And the Celtics, meanwhile, are the exact opposite.
The exact opposite, yeah. They're dealing with different guys injured every game, which makes it really hard to nail down your chemistry because it screws up all the rotations and matchups. And, you can see the frustration on the court with some of the performances we've been seeing lately. And, once the playoffs start, everyone goes back to 0-0. I mean, obviously you want a high seed so you can get home court, but you got to win on the road if you want to win, get to the finals anyway. So it's just you've got to keep at it and hopefully get things to click so that by the time when playoffs are starting, try to make a run and utilize all this potential and talent and depth we've been talking about all year.
This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. Up next, the manager of the Boston Red Sox to preview the Red Sox season, Alex Cora. Welcome back. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. Boston Red Sox, the defending World Series champions, they open up their season against the Seattle Mariners, and that game on Thursday, as we do the show here on Monday night. And Alex Cora is the manager of that squad. We're going to hear from him in a moment. First, want to let you know this segment of the program is presented by Douglas Leonard and Garvey. If you've been injured, the most important decision you're going to make is who your lawyer is going to be. I encourage you to check out nhlawoffice.com. Joined by the manager of the Boston Red Sox, Alex Cora. And obviously, this is a special group of guys, and this is a special challenge you guys have in front of you in trying to repeat. How do you go about embracing that challenge and keeping the group motivated and focused throughout the course of the year?
I mean, the group wants to be great, and that's the bottom line. And we had something special last year. Nobody has repeated since the late 90s, and it'll be awesome to do it again. Been in the conversation of the greatest teams in MLB history, doing what we have in mind will be awesome. So I don't think you have to push them too hard. Since day one here in spring training, doing the drills and doing everything, it's been very sharp. They've been locked in, and it's just a matter of keep going through the progressions and stay healthy and be ready for March 28th.
I was talking to Tony La Russa about the challenge from a managerial perspective of trying to keep a team focused on team things after winning a championship, is at times guys start to drift and focus more on individual aspects of the game. Do you see that being a problem with this group at all, or how do you go about reining that in and creating an environment where is everything pretty much all set?
Well, nothing changes. We're still preaching the same things that we did last year. We believe in a few things that made us good last year and that gonna keep us going after it the right way. If you do the things that you're supposed to, the other stuff will take care of itself. So just show up and go through your progressions and do the things the right way. It's going to put it in the spot for us to be successful, and nothing's going to change.
A lot of discussion about the bullpen here at spring training. Do you feel the need to have a defined closer going into the season, or do you feel that matchups, situations, can dictate who your closer is going to be, quote unquote, on a day in, day out basis?
We'll have to wait on March 28th. I know that's a question everybody's been pushing me to answer. And when we play Seattle and the late innings come and we have the lead, we're going to manage it the way we're very comfortable with. We got some guys that can get people out in any spot. We got guys that can become closer. So I'll leave it at that. I think people have to wait and see, and we're going to be in a good spot.
I really like what you've done flipping Mookie and Benny in the lineup. What's the thought process behind that? And Benny just seems like a really good modern day leadoff hitter, and obviously given Mookie a little bit more in terms of opportunities to drive in runs. Is that something you thought about last year, or did it just kind of come about in the offseason?
No, last year there was no way I was going to change my top two hitters. Mm-hmm. It was something that we talk about it in the offseason, and we wanted it that way. This year, obviously, it's a new year. It's a new challenge, and you know, Benny did an outstanding job when he led off last year when Mookie was hurt. You know, as far as opportunities to drive in runs, well, Mookie's going to get more. It's not that I want to take away opportunities for Benny, but you know, he'll be the same guy. You know, he's aggressive in the strike zone. We want him to do damage early in counts. If the pitch is in the middle of the zone, nothing is going to change. So I think it's a good way. You know, a good way to. I changed things a little bit, and it makes sense as far as like the lineup complexion.
You've had Devers at the number three spot, and you've said that that's not necessarily going to be what happens during the course of the regular season. And it was interesting what you did at the number three spot last year, too, with Pierce and Moreland. What is your philosophy in regards to, you know, that spot in the lineup, and do you see Devers as being what you want to happen in that spot?
Ruff is a good hitter, and he drove in a lot of runs late in September and in October, so... It's just a matter of see where we at towards the end of the season and make decisions. You know, Piercy most likely against lefties, he's going to hit third. Against righties, you know, Mitch hit most of the time against them in the third spot. So we'll see. I'm just pushing the kid to something new. And I know he's up to the challenge. He showed up in great shape. He's having a good camp. You can see him, you know. His desire to hit in between those two guys. So, you know, just like the bullpen, just like most of the questions, you know, we're going to have to wait and see see where we at the end of camp and then just put that lineup. And one thing for sure, on a daily basis, on a nightly basis, our lineup is going to be a good offensive lineup. So it really doesn't matter where we put him. We're going to be able to score runs.
Christian Vasquez is having a really good camp, in my view, both in terms of the way he's swinging the bat and also how he's kind of taken command of the catching position. What have been your thoughts on what you've seen from him, and is he, you know, one of the guys having the better of camps?
I mean, he finished the season very strong in the regular season last year, and then the playoffs, you saw what happened. He took charge, and he did an outstanding job with us behind the plate during the playoffs, and he worked on a few things in the off season, working with his swing. He looks like he's in better shape. You know, he's moving a lot better behind the plate, and I think that the whole October experience put him in another level as far as like command and what he wants from the pitchers, and they respect him. So we're very happy with where he's at, and looking forward to, you know, for him to keep getting better.
Last year, you eased the starting pitchers into spring training because guys very often try to do a little bit too much too early during spring training. You did the same thing this year with some of the relievers as well. Do you see that being kind of the trend that we see in baseball moving forward? Because it seems like teams are not quite yet catching on to what you guys have done when you look at what other groups are doing down here.
I don't know. That's something you got to ask the other teams about it, but... We believe in our program. We believe in the things that we're doing. We believe that they're in a good spot. You know, David was hitting 94 today on mm-hmm. his first outing. And innings-wise, although in the stats it says only three, he has plenty of innings in the backfield. So we're in a good spot. They're healthy, which is the most important thing. Now we're going to go through a progression, and they'll be ready for March 28th.
Those guys seem to be remarkably competitive, up and down. Like, no matter what is going on there, whether it's doing interviews or doing whatever they are, they're competitive. They ask questions. They push back. They are remarkably smart guys as well. Are they unique in how they approach the game and how they think about the game from your perspective? Or is there, you know, they kind of just general what you'd find with starting pitchers?
I mean, the Scherzers, the Verlanders, the veteran guys that have made adjustments throughout their careers, and they still throwing. And those are the ones that ask questions, look for information, and they push themselves to be better. CC Sabathia, for example, you know, a guy that used to throw 98, and now he cuts it, and he's still doing an outstanding job. And we have a group here that they're very proud too, proud individuals, and they want to be the best. And you know, I think competition is great within them. It's not that they're, you know, they want to be better than the other one, but they want to keep that relay race going. You know, you pass the baton to the next guy, he'll run 100 and he'll give it to the other guy, and they keep going, keep going, keep going. And it's cool to see, not only on the mound, but in the clubhouse, outside the clubhouse, they do an outstanding job.
How do you think your experience from last year benefits you moving forward, where you saw and had to manage in just about every pressure situation imaginable, and you were able to make, you know, the right decisions in the right spots? Does that help you, or did you have the confidence in your ability to make those decisions and did not need the affirmation of the success that took place?
Affirmation I don't need. I believe in what we do. I got a great group of coaches that they helped me out throughout the season, through spring training. It helped me out through the playoffs. It's not just me making decisions. It's a team effort. And the organization do an outstanding job giving us information, and the players at the end, they're very talented. So I'm just lucky to be here in this special situation, and just try to keep it simple, put them in situations that they're going to be successful, and then at the end they take over. And those are the ones that, they hit, they run, they pitch, they play defense. So the credit goes to the players.
Final thing on the players themselves and what they were able to do last year, whether it's David Price, Jackie Bradley Jr., individuals that had not experienced the postseason success that they did last year, or really a lot of postseason success in general. Do you feel that experience and that success is going to indicate, future positive performances for them now that there's that comfort and now that they're more confident perhaps in their ability?
I don't know, man. They were good players before having success in the playoffs. It's just, small sample size, works in different ways. I always said that in the playoffs, a guy that is 2-for-10 is in a slump. The guy that is 3-for-10, he's hot in the playoffs. It's just such a small sample size, and we don't believe in that. We believe in the individuals, their talent, and all the guys that you name, they had great careers. So we believe the individual. We trust in the player. We trust the player, and they're going
to
be fine.
Alex, great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Sweet. Appreciate it.
See you, bro.
That is Red Sox manager Alex Cora. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. Welcome back. This is The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. This segment of the show brought to you by the Prescription Center, where the health of you and your family comes first. And we're going to bring in my good friend Dave D'Onofrio from Boston.com, who's covered the Patriots for years and covered Rob Gronkowski for the majority of his career. Of course, I've spent a lot of time around Gronk as well. We talk about a true sports legend in Rob Gronkowski, Dave D'Onofrio from Boston.com. And I think Rob Gronkowski had made this decision a long time ago, and we've talked about it, leading up to the Super Bowl and during the course of the year, that this was likely going to be Rob Gronkowski's last season. And he announced via Instagram yesterday that, in fact, that was the case, that at the age of 29, he's retiring from the NFL and is going to move on to future endeavors, which will likely involve just about everything over the course of the remainder of his life. And I was thinking about this, yesterday was it was Sunday, but it was an insane news day, obviously, with the revealing of the Barr letter in regards to the Mueller report on the political side of things. And then one of the legends of New England sports and really football, and Rob Gronkowski retiring. And, at times we can get involved in overrating individuals and situations, and everything's the best, particularly in the moment and such. But I don't think that there has ever been a tight end, certainly, who was as dominant and prolific as, Rob Gronkowski. And, the Patriots have seen one in Ben Coates, and Rob Gronkowski, in terms of the ability to block and in his heyday, was an unstoppable force. He was the most lethal non-quarterback offensive weapon in the NFL for a sustained period of time, and is on his way to Canton, Ohio.
Yeah, and there had been tight ends who caught the ball before, oversized receivers, basically. A guy like Shannon Sharpe comes to mind, who had a lot of success, who got to Canton based on what they'd done in the receiving game. Tony Gonzalez is another one. But there's never been anyone who combined the two big skills of that position, being blocking and receiving, and did them both at a close to, if not Hall of Fame level, as Gronkowski did. He almost could have been the best of all time at either of those skills. And you could make a case for other guys like Gonzalez as far as the receiving goes, but Gonzalez wasn't the blocker Gronkowski was. And then you could make the case that others have been as good of a blocker, but they certainly didn't catch the ball as well or get open as well or, you know, really revolutionize the position and NFL offenses the way that Gronk did. Mm-hmm. And some of that early in his career was alongside Aaron Hernandez, who for all his horrible failures as a person was another great weapon, and you just look at them side by side on the field at least, and one they were played the same position technically, but they were two very different guys, and those two and what they did, you know, 6-7 years ago really changed the way NFL teams look at tight end, look at formation groups. And to do all that and also put up the numbers that Gronkowski did, I mean, 79 touchdowns in 9 seasons is ridiculous, especially considering how often he was injured.
Yeah, we talk a lot about players in sports who are just unstoppable, and you can't stop them, you hope to contain them. And Gronkowski, you know, was almost not containable at times. During his prime, you know, you would have teams double team him, triple team him at times, and he'd still catch the ball, and he'd still get a positive yardage after the catch. And that's not hyperbole. I mean, you can point to a number of circumstances where that took place. And you know, the individuals that you're mentioning were all great players. We've seen great receivers in the NFL, but how many guys can you double or triple team and have them still be able to have success? That is such a rare thing in all of sports. And that is something that Gronkowski could do due to his size, his speed, and his determination as well. I mean, he was driven to be the best. And, you know, for all of his, you know, goofiness off the field and, you know, his fun-loving personality, when it came to football, dude was all business. And, you know, that competitiveness, that determination, combined with his size and his skill, made him one of the best offensive weapons ever. And you know, that's the guys you mentioned, great tight ends. There's been great receivers in the game, but Gronkowski was just different because of his size, his skill, the competitiveness. And he, you know, stands alone as one of the great, great NFL legends.
Yeah, his physical attributes alone made him almost impossible to cover because you couldn't do it with a safety. Because he probably wasn't big enough. You couldn't do it with a cornerback because he wasn't big enough, but you couldn't do it with a linebacker either because that guy would just be 5 yards behind Gronk by the time Gronk was 20 yards downfield and right up that seam. And there was no defensive equivalent, really. I mean, there were guys who had more success than others. There were teams that double-teamed him, even triple-teamed him. But that's where, you know, a lot of opportunities were opened for Edelman or other guys.
Gronk was like what it must have been like to try to guard Wilt Chamberlain, like in the 60s, the early 60s, where you know, you have just this mammoth figure, and you have great players of the day, but there was just nobody that could compete with Gronk.
It's a good analogy because Wilt was all of that, plus he had a ton of skill.
Right.
Gronk is all of that, plus he has great hands. And
right.
You know, I watched some of the highlights that they were showing last night as the various networks were discussing this, and you forget, like, oh yeah, not only is it impossible to cover him, but if the ball is anywhere in his area, his hands are good enough that he's going to catch it with one hand, or in traffic, or pull it away, or he's going to adjust.
With guys draped on him.
I don't know if we'll ever see anyone like.
Yeah, he'd make one-hand catches with guys draped on him, and tracking guys down the field. He was a unique offensive weapon of which, you know, we're very unlikely to see again. I mean, there'll be guys like that. Ben Coates, as I mentioned before, was like Gronk, but he didn't have the pass blocking ability or the speed, and a great player in his own right, but just was not where Gronk was. And obviously we saw over the course of the last year that he was not, you know, where he had been previous. You could see the injuries had taken their toll, and this was the best thing for him. And, you know, we talked about that during the course of the season. Yeah, I mean, he could still play. I mean, he could still, I have no doubt that Gronk could play 2, 3, 4 more years. But how effective would he be? What would the long-term effect be?
on him and his personal health. How much would he actually play during the course of the season? This is just the best thing for everybody in my view. And you know, I'm glad that he is, you know, putting himself and his long-term health down the road. I mean, he's had back surgery. He's had surgery on just about everything. And you know, this is just the best thing for him, and I think everybody moving forward.
Yeah, when we had we were talking about this in late December, early January, I was pretty convinced that this was how it was going to happen. But I think in the months since then,
right, there's been so much time
changed. Yeah, it's obviously been what 7 or 8 weeks since the Super Bowl. So that was with each passing day, I kind of figured he was more coming back than not. And then you look at what he did in the playoffs, and he was a force in the blocking game in that San Diego win, or sorry, the first Los Angeles win. Then it was him who converted 3rd and 10 on the drive in the fourth quarter that puts them ahead of the Chiefs. And then if you look at the 69-yard touchdown drive, that was the only touchdown drive of the Super Bowl, he gets it started with, I think, a 22-yard reception on first down, gets him to midfield, basically. And then it's his catch, again, in traffic, that brings them down to the 2. And one play later, Sony Michel runs it in. So the playoffs, he was excellent. He was a force. He was one of the reasons that they did what they did.
Yeah.
And so with that sort of bump at the end and the time that had passed, I thought maybe he had deferred that. But I'm also not more than 50% convinced that this is it. Based on the way it happened yesterday, the team didn't seem to be prepared for it. He did it on Instagram, seemingly without an editor or an agent looking at it first. It wouldn't surprise me if, like, he shows up in WrestleMania in a couple weeks, does that. Then we hear he's making a movie over the summer. And then all of a sudden, rumors start in November that maybe Gronk would entertain playing in the second half of the season. And, oh, he's still under contract with the Patriots. And, oh, the Patriots are amenable to getting him back. Yeah. That scenario would not surprise me at all. If he just looked at this whole off season and said, I don't want to get ready for football again. I want to try this other stuff, but I'm not entirely done with football. If that was in the back of his head right now, it would not surprise me in the least.
Yeah. If that's the situation, as opposed to him, you know, taking a couple months off and still not feeling right. And that being the thing where he's, yeah, my back is not great, and this still hurts, and I just don't want to go through this again because of the pain level. You know, that's one thing. If it's, yeah, he wants to partake in new opportunities, or perhaps it's more likely a combination of the two. Yeah, I'm not completely shutting the door on him, particularly, you know, given how much he means the Patriots just being out there on the field. I mean, this is a huge, huge loss for them, regardless of the drop in his production. When you have to game plan for him, and where the first and foremost thing in your mind from the opposition standpoint is Gronk, even if he's not 100%, you have to account for him. You have to be extremely diligent in that. So his loss is huge for the Patriots. It's despite, you know, where he is at this point in his career, banged up and so forth. They have not had a loss like this during the course of their championship reign, in my view.
No, and especially considering what it leaves them with. I mean, we said some of the same things with Trey Flowers, where it was like, okay, now what is the replacement plan? What's going next? And they don't really even have a viable starting tight end option at this point. We know what they've already gone through at the receiver position as far as it being now Edelman, Dorsett, and virtually nothing. So who are they throwing the ball to? Like, I guess maybe their path through the playoffs laid out or revealed a little bit their plan for being more run-centric, ground and pound, rely on the defense type of team. Maybe that's part of it, but still, you need a good blocking tight end. Still, you need options in the red zone. You need a guy who's going to convert on 3rd and 10 for you. And right now, it's Edelman or who?
Right.
And that's where even the threat of Gronk was such a massive factor, because you couldn't just fixate on one thing, because, you know, he may not be out there for 20 targets a game anymore, but when they throw to Gronk those 8 or 9 times, he could still make something happen with it. And now, now the guys they have, you don't even have to. You don't have to worry about him, really.
You've been listening to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. That's Dave D'Onofrio, along with myself, have covered Rob Gronkowski a lot during the 9-year career for Gronk. Happy trails to Rob Gronkowski. You've been listening to The Life with Matt Bonner, presented by Concord Orthopedics. I am Chris Ryan. That segment of the show brought to you by the Prescription Center.